listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. Stay tuned for Arab Voices next. Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Today on the show, we will listen to a special podcast from the Electronic Intifada. But first, let's start with Arab Voices community calendar. The bilateral U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce has selected experts from Houston Methodist Hospital, Texas Children's Global Health Initiative, the City of Houston Department of Health and Human Services, and the Houston Airport System to provide awareness and perspectives on mitigating the recent global health crisis about Ebola and MERS. This timely event will be held tomorrow, Thursday, October 2nd at 11:30 a.m. For more information or to register, visit bilateralchamber.org. A protest is scheduled against the U.S. military intervention in Iraq and Syria, organized by the Progressive Workers Organizing Committee and Friends, will be held on Saturday, October 4th at 2 p.m. at the corner of Westheimer and Post Oak in the Galleria area. Maram Foundation will hold the annual Spread the Smiles Eid Festival for Charity this coming Sunday. It will be a day of fun and delicious food. This Eid Festival will benefit the children of the Syrian crisis, and it will be held on Sunday, October 5th from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center on 10555 Stancliffe Road. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit maramfoundation.org. Kentucky-based artist Gerald Fertzman has an art exhibit exploring the current conflict in Syria through his exhibition, I Spy, I Love the Smell of Gas and Bombs, Recent Paintings by Gerald Fertzman. And that is currently on display through October 23rd at the University of Houston Clear Lake Art Gallery. The gallery is presenting three community programs in conjunction with the exhibition. They include a panel discussion in the art gallery about Syria on October 8th and a lecture about Syria by Joshua Landis on October 23rd following a screening of the award-winning documentary Return to Homs. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center in Houston will hold its 21st anniversary gala on October 11th under the theme Moving Forward. This year, the ACC will be honoring Dr. Kamal Khalil with the Outstanding Community Service Award and Dr. Samia Khalil with the Lifetime Achievement Award. Farouk Systems will also be the 2014 ACC Outstanding Philanthropic Honoree. During the gala, the ACC will be highlighting the culture and people of Morocco. There will be live entertainment, performances, fashion show, the Houston Children's Chorus, and silent auction with a Moroccan bazaar. The mistress of ceremonies will be Miss Sonia Azad with ABC Channel 13. The gala will be held on Saturday, October 11th at the Omni Hotel on 4 Riverway. For more information, contact the ACC at 832-351-3366. Al-Awda, the Right to Return Coalition, Houston chapter, will hold a general meeting to talk about Al-Awda global, national, and local accomplishments and goals, and also select a committee for Al-Awda Houston. This meeting will be held on October 15th at 7 p.m. at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center on 10555 Stancliffe Road. The World Affairs Council of Houston will hold an event titled What Happens in Syria Does Not Stay in Syria. The speaker will be Joshua Landis, who teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics as an associate professor and director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. This event will be held on October 20th at 6 p.m. at the Junior League on 1811 Briar Oaks Lane. For more information, visit wachouston.org. And the International Studies Society at St. Thomas University and the Distinguished Diplomacy Program will host a free event for Nicole Miner, co-author of Open Doors, Women of the Holy Land Share Their Stories, as she reveals an intimate portrait of both Israeli and Palestinian women's lives, including the realities, conditions, and histories that shape their identities. This event will be held on October 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at the University of St. Thomas Little Art Gallery. For more information, contact Diana at 713-525-3530. And there is one more event scheduled to take place this coming Friday, October 3rd, right here in Houston, and that is titled Not in My Name, and it's an awareness rally. And joining us now live via phone to talk about this particular rally is Ahmed Al-Aswad. He is one of the organizers for this event, and he is also a representative for CARE Houston, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Ahmed, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you so much, Sayed.
Thanks. We appreciate your time. It's
Thank you. A
rally to be held this Friday called Not In My Name. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so on Friday at 3 p.m. at the intersection of Post Oak and Westheimer, we're going to have a rally that is called hashtag Not In My Name. This is a phenomenon that's happening in social media where Muslims are going and denouncing it, ISIS. And that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be holding posters, having a press conference denouncing what ISIS is doing in Syria and Iraq.
And this is a collective effort that several individuals and organizations, I believe, are behind it?
Yes. We're having Houstonian Muslim gathering and working together. We also have different organizations participating in this, and we're all unifying ourselves with the message of ISIS does not represent Islam.
And that is important to put out there and to make sure that people truly understand, and I would like to get your feedback on that, because simply because of the name of it, you know, it's so-called, they call themselves Islamic State, and as we know, it has taken parts of Syria and parts of Iraq, but the actions and what they are doing are far, far from being Islamic. And as a matter of fact, they are the opposite and anti-Islamic from their actions and what they are doing and what have they done. So why is this so critical for you to make it clear for everybody, obviously, that this is not in my name, this is not Islam?
Sure. So while I work for the Council on American Islamic Relations, we've actually seen an increased number of anti-Islamic activities from our politicians who are calling that ISIS and the Islamic situation, and they're saying that ISIS represents Islam, which is far from the truth. Just yesterday, actually in Australia, there was a man who pushed a Muslim because she was Muslim, and he's still on the loose. And that's what's happening here in America, where in Oklahoma where people are saying that the guy who beheaded the person is an ISIS person supporter, which, again, is far from the truth. ISIS does not represent Islam. We have thousands of scholars saying that ISIS is far from Islam, not only anti-Islamic, but un-Islamic.
And you mentioned the thousands of scholars have spoken clearly about it last Wednesday, as a matter of fact, and we reported about it here on Arab Voices. The Council on American Islamic Relations, national, your organization,
exactly,
in cooperation with many other organizations, including the Fiqh Council of North America, they joined national, local Muslim scholars from all around, hundreds of them. They actually sent a letter to the leaders,
yes,
of ISIS, some 28-page open letter, exactly, basically telling them that all those things that they are doing, from killing of the innocents to the so-called jihad they are claiming, to declaring people non-Muslim to be killed and tortured and beheading, that is completely un-Islamic, and they use the Quran, even verses from the Quran, to prove that what they are doing is wrong and it does not represent Islam.
And it's actually one key point that I want to say is that here in our American Muslims, we need to go out to the community, do community service, sweat equity, getting involved, because once we have value in the community, they will know that ISIS does not represent Islam. And that is why it's very important for everyone who is listening to participate in this rally, because the more people that we have, the stronger the message will be.
So this is going to be open for everybody, and you're calling upon all that can attend to make it. And give us more information again one more time about the details, location, and time, please.
Sure. We're calling for all Houstonians. It doesn't necessarily have to be Muslims. We're getting the interfaith community involved as well. And it's going to be in the intersection of Post Oak and Westheimer at 3 p.m. on Friday. And I know that that day is going to be Arafat, and that's a very important day for the Muslims. But that is why it's so imperative for us to go out there.
Very well. And I have more details on it posted on our website for those who need more information. And that's arabvoices.net. And we'll put a link also to the Facebook page that you have about it. Well, thank you so much, Ahmed Al-Aswad, one of the organizers for this awareness rally, hashtag not in my name. We greatly appreciate your time, Ahmed, today.
And thank you so much for all that you do.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And next, we are going to move on to a different story, and that's the second segment that I have for the show, or the main segment, if you will, and that is about a special podcast by the Electronic Intifada. The Electronic Intifada produced a special program last week about how basic medical equipment and medicine that are desperately needed in Gaza after Israel's onslaught on the Gaza Strip are not making it there. And it also talks about the personal and collective psychological trauma for Palestinians after Israel's onslaught on Gaza, in addition to two more topics. We will listen to this today on Arab Voices, and the voice you will hear is that of Noura Barros Friedman, a staff writer and editor with the Electronic Intifada. Let's listen in.
This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, after Israel's attacks created thousands of new patients with physical disabilities in Gaza, patients and doctors are still waiting for basic medical equipment and medicines to arrive as Egypt and Israel maintain a tight blockade. We'll speak with Dr. Basman Alashi, the executive director of Al-Wafa Hospital, Gaza's only rehabilitation hospital, which was bombed to rubble in July.
The Egyptian side is totally restricting any entry of any medical equipment and medicines to Gaza.
Also, human rights advocate Khalil Abu Shamala on the personal and collective psychological trauma after Israel's onslaught. Ohio University's Student Senate president takes a stand for Palestine and receives death threats and threats of rape, while the university administration criticizes her action instead of protecting her freedom of speech. And a report from Palos Hills near Chicago on a local action to support children in Gaza. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland, with Nader Ahmoud in Chicago. A new United Nations assessment report lays out the massive scope of the needs facing the nearly 1.8 million Palestinians in Gaza following the unprecedented destruction wreaked by Israel during its 51 days of bombing in July and August. The Electronic Intifada reported that Israel's assault, which it dubbed Operation Protective Edge, left at least 2,133 Palestinians dead and more than 11,000 injured. More than 100,000 are permanently homeless, as some 13% of Gaza's housing stock, more than 44,000 housing units, was affected by the attack, with 5% rendered completely uninhabitable. The UN report indicates that almost everyone in every part of Gaza faces some urgent need for basic protection, health care and rehabilitation, housing, water, food security, or education. The report came out the same day that the UN and the Palestinian Authority launched a $551 million emergency appeal to meet urgent humanitarian needs in Gaza. The assessment also identifies the need for legal support to address some of the protection needs, including pursuing accountability for alleged violations of international law resulting in deaths and injuries, as well as destruction of property as a result of the military operation. During Israel's 51 days of attacks, along with destroying thousands of homes and offices, schools, hospitals, and medical clinics, the army bombed the Al-Wafa Rehabilitation and Geriatric Hospital in a series of airstrikes, leveling the entire building to the ground. This came after weeks of threats to doctors and hospital staff that the hospital was going to be attacked. The hospital's executive director, Basman Alashi, and his staff were able to evacuate the patients, some needing round-the-clock care and monitoring, to other locations, including relatives' homes. Dr. Alashi said that though the patients are being cared for by his team of dedicated caregivers, the need for medical and rehabilitation equipment is immediate and critical. Meanwhile, Israel and Egypt continue its tight blockade, and necessary life-saving machines and physical therapy machines are not being allowed in. Oxfam has said that, quote, only a full opening of all crossings to people and goods, including exports, will enable Palestinian civilians in Gaza to restore their economy and escape the poverty that the blockade has entrenched. The international community must press Israel for the blockade to be fully lifted rather than only eased. The International Committee of the Red Cross has long viewed the siege of Gaza as illegal collective punishment. But as the Electronic Intifada added, since the August 26th ceasefire, uncertainty and mystery continue to shroud the understandings reached by Israel and Palestinian resistance organizations regarding the movement of goods and people in and out of Gaza. Although the ceasefire understandings were not made public, media reported that they, quote, include opening all crossings to Gaza, allowing reconstruction of damaged infrastructure, allowing the entry of materials needed for reconstruction, and permitting fishing for a distance of 6 to 12 nautical miles from shore. I spoke with Dr. Basman Alashi on September 17th from his home in Gaza about the conditions he and his staff continue to face under the Israeli-Egyptian siege. It's been 2 months since Israel bombed your hospital. What has happened to the patients and where are they being cared for right now?
My patients, my staff are taking care of them in a new location. That location belongs to Al-Wafa Hospital, but it was designed for the elderly as a housing for them at no charge. We house them and maintain them with all the medical needs, the health needs, the hygiene needs at no charge, since those people have no body or relatives to maintain them. The building is in 4,000 square meters. We took the first and the second floor, which is about total about 2,000 square meters, and we accommodate all our patients, and we are receiving new patients from local hospitals. Our capacity is over 50 beds, and we were able to not fully return to full function, but at least we are 70% back doing the same thing, except the surgery room, that we are unable to have somebody to let it enter Gaza because of the restrictions from Egyptian side or the Israeli side.
Well, the blockade seems to still be in place, of course, as you just said. Are patients who have had limbs amputated, for example, able to receive prosthetics? And are your staff able to access the sort of life-saving machines or rehabilitation machines that you were able to use at Al-Wafa before the bombing?
The machines that we are using now, it's very primitive machines. It is totally not exactly the same machines that we used to have at Al-Wafa Hospital, the old building that was destroyed by the Israelis. But right now we are using mainly 50% our hands, hot pads and cold pads, but other equipment, the walking, the ability to stretch the muscles, the ability to flex the muscles. These machines, many local and international charity organizations or government had promised to supply to us, but these promises has not been fulfilled yet, and we are just waiting. But we, because of the expertise of our staff, they were able to give the proper care to our patients, despite that we don't have all the machines, because of their expertise and the long term of being in that kind of business. And to measure this, we are receiving more patients every day. Those are injured ones from the war on Gaza, for that 51-day war by the Israelis. These patients are young, old, women and men. There's no distinction whatever they are. And we are giving the proper. People are leaving, walking. They come crawling or in a wheelchair, but they still leave walking from the hospital. And we were able, with the miracles, to bring them back to be a functioning citizen. The Egyptian side is totally restricting any entry of any medical equipment and medicines to Gaza. We have an ambulance. Our ambulance was destroyed in the war. We have requested an ambulance, and the Malaysian organization have promised that they will supply us with ambulance. They brought the ambulance all the way to Egypt, and they are right now waiting for the Egyptian to give them permission to enter Gaza. And it has been more than 30 days, and they have not heard any reply from them. So the Egyptians are not letting any medicines. The Israelis are letting some basic medicines coming to them because of the international pressure on them. But in terms of who allows medicines and statics and all these needed to the hospital, the Israelis are allowing, but the Egyptians are really zero tolerance. They're not allowing anything in.
Wow. Dr. Alashi, you said in an earlier interview with us that there is now an entirely new generation of people with physical and mental disabilities, you know, amongst the 11,000 people injured in Israel's 51 days of attacks. How are the doctors and staff at Al-Wafa able to assess the kinds of needs of patients right now when you're capabilities are limited, when the supplies are limited, and when you're working with, as you said, primitive machines?
We assess the injured are more than the one that need medical rehabilitation. There are more than 50% of the injured. None of the hospitals here in Gaza will be able to handle all that number. So Al Wafa Hospital created an outreach program. That program will go to the homes of the people and the injured one, Shijaya especially, since we were part of that side of Gaza. We went home, helping people, helping the injured, or if they need any assistance. So that outreach program give medicine, basic medicine, give basic training how to take care of their wounds, how to train the family inside there, how to take care of the wounds and their ill ones. That outreach program has taken a lot from Al-Wafa Hospital in terms of financial ability, but since our mission is a mercy mission and a mission to help the Palestinians in Gaza, we have pushed ourselves to the limit that we help every patient that we are able to reach by this outreach program, which is it gives medical rehabilitation, medical supplies, wheelchairs, walkers, and just waterbed or airbed, so we can reach as much people as we can. We cannot accommodate 50% of the injured. This will be 5,000. Our hospital can only accommodate 50. So we went there to them, to their homes, so we can help them. And we are the only hospital in Gaza that has created such a program. And we are very successful in it. Even financially, we are in a very tight budget.
Finally, Dr. Alashi, Al-Wafa Hospital was completely bombed to rubble and dust. Are there plans yet to rebuild Al-Wafa?
Our plan is to rebuild Al-Wafa. We have selected a new location in the middle of the town. We are right now seeking the financial support to rebuild the hospital. We have signed a new contract with the government and with other local hospitals to continue our services, because we are the only hospital that gives complete medical rehabilitation to Palestinians in Gaza. We are the oldest and the most experienced one. So Gaza without Al-Wafa will suffer a lot in terms of that medical rehabilitation. And the government, local hospitals, supported us and asking us to continue the service, do not stop. So we have located a new 4,000 square meters in the middle of the city. Right now it's going to take us a year or a year and a half to rebuild this hospital. And with the help of God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we will be able to come back with full function to help humanity and to help the Palestinians in Gaza.
Dr. Basman Alashi, you're the Executive Director of Al-Wafa Rehabilitation and Geriatric Hospital in Gaza. Thank you so much for your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Noor. Thank you very much. And I wish for all the listeners and all the people who's going to read this that to pray to us, pray for us, ask God to help us and to protect the Palestinians and to end the blockade on Gaza.
We continue our reporting on Gaza. Khalil Abu Shamala, the director of the Ad-Damir Association for Human Rights, based in the Gaza Strip, spoke with the Electronic Intifada on September 16th, the day after it was reported that several hundred Palestinians escaping Gaza by boat had been murdered by smugglers in the Mediterranean. Nearly 500 people are believed to have drowned after setting sail from Egypt, fleeing countries across North Africa and the Middle East ravaged by war, epidemic, and instability. Many of the people on board are believed to have been Palestinians from Gaza, thousands of whom are said to have fled since Israel began its devastating 51-day offensive on July 7th. Survivors have told the International Organization for Migration that the same men who had taken their money and agreed to transport them to Europe from Egypt turned against the crowded ship when passengers refused to transfer to a smaller, reportedly unsafe boat. At this point, the smugglers then deliberately rammed their own ship into the passenger vessel, causing it to sink and take hundreds down with it. Khalil Abu Shamala spoke to us from his home in Gaza on September 16th. As you look around your own neighborhood or the neighborhood where Ad-Damir Association for Human Rights is located, How can you assess the immediate needs, what people need the most right now in the weeks following Israel's attacks?
We cannot talk about just one need. In fact, we are talking, for example, about 56,000 of refugees who are distributed into 22 schools. Where their homes have been destroyed, completely destroyed, not partially, by the Israel bomb, whether during the ground offense or by the war plans. Mainly these people are from east of Khan Yunis, and east of Gaza City, Shuja'iya, and north of Gaza in Beit Hanun. And imagine how these people suffer during their stay. They depend mainly on the services provided by the UN and international relief NGOs and the Ministry of Social Affairs. The second need. People are waiting for the beginning of the reconstruction, the wide destruction in Gaza is very critical. And you can talk about every 100 meters in Gaza, you will find several or specific type of destruction. As a result of the Israel bombs. In addition to this, the school's semester started 2 days ago, and all of the schools, whether the governmental or UN school, they started from the first day, and they will continue for the first week to. The psychotherapy for the students and the pupils at the schools. But those who make these psychotherapy exercises, they need themselves the psychotherapy because they are affected also by the war. It seems you can solve that. All of the Gazans, all of the population in Gaza need psychotherapy exercises and should be done by external experts to enable these people to continue and to look forward to a better future. One of the most dangerous impacts of the war, the huge number of people who flee from Gaza during and right now through the tunnels, and they pay money to for immigration through the Mediterranean in Alexandria, and just last night we received that one of the port containing maybe 400 to 450 of immigrants, most of them are from Gaza, they were died in the middle of the Mediterranean. People started to receive this news since last night. Today, Gaza is... all of the homes, every citizen in Gaza talks about this catastrophe, and this is the first time to see such immigration campaign. It's illegal campaigns, but they escape from the situation, the reality. They live in Gaza. 7 years of a blockade, three wars in 6 years, and no hope, no reconstruction, no any real impact, political impact on the ground, high average of poverty, high average of unemployment. Imagine most of the young people who are in the, they reach 30 years old and they don't have any opportunity for job, or they cannot at this age think of building or establishing a family. So it's not food, it's not money, it is the needs of any human being, because the Gazans are not looking for a specific type of life. They are looking for a life itself, and they don't have the option to choose any type of life.
That's such horrible news, such horrible news. Khalil, what has it been like for you personally as a human rights worker, but also as a father and as a husband, to have lived through this kind of onslaught over and over and over again, and to see these kinds of desperate acts that people in Gaza are forced to take just to be able to live, a normal life with basic rights?
Yeah, do you know what, I'm talking, and while my wife is here listening and looking at me, my two kids are watching Real Madrid match, but they are listening to what I'm talking about. Do you know what? When the last night of the war, give you an life example. The last night of the war before the ceasefire, all of the people who live in our buildings left their apartments because they were worrying of the destroying our building after the Israelis started a campaign again at the towers. They destroyed four towers, and people because a rocket thrown for a couple of meters beside our building. That's why all of the people left the apartments, and I came late afternoon in the afternoon at that date, and I looked at my family eyes. The youngest daughter, Nisma, she said to me, "Look, Dad, we don't want to leave our apartment because if we will die, we will die anywhere. So there is no reason or justification or no security place to go there or here or there." And I decided to stay with them at that night. But they slept, but I continued, walked up until 6 in the morning, following and monitoring and waiting and expecting the worst. As a husband, as a father, I had the same feeling of the other of any father in Gaza. My friend Sam Yunus, he is the director of the Mizan Center for Human Rights. This morning he was talking about immigration, and he was talking about what kind of a future we can deserve for our family or our sons. We paid the price, but we don't need our sons and family to continue paying the price without doing anything for their better life. It's very terrible, and we are in a big dilemma. We are on our land, we are under occupation, under political split, no hope, and you live in a very unique place. You cannot plan for 2 days, so you cannot complete and totally cannot talk about any strategy in your life, whether in the personal dimension or in the family dimension. So you can imagine, and Gaza is a bigger prison. Everything is paralyzed. No unity, no government, and the political conflict between Fatah and Hamas, Abu Mazen and Hamas, is continuing even after this bloody war and the tragedy impact of the war.
Well, Khalil Abu Shamela, we're so glad that you and your family are safe. You are the director of the Ad-Damir Association for Human Rights in Gaza. And Khalil, thank you so much for all of the work that you do and for being
thank
with us
so
today on the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you.
We now turn to Ohio. As the Electronic Intifada reported, Ohio University's Student Senate President Megan Marzek has been at the center of a targeted campaign by anti-Palestinian individuals and Zionist groups calling for her resignation after she filmed herself pouring a bucket of fake blood over her head to protest Israel's abuse of Palestinians on September 2nd. Marzek was remixing the mainstream ice bucket challenge people have been doing to raise money for ALS medical research. She was nominated to do the ice bucket challenge by Ohio University's president, Roderick McDavis, and she decided to subvert the meme, as Palestinians have done with their own rubble bucket challenge, and called for the end to Israel's occupation and in support of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Marzek was quickly and swiftly denounced. The Twitter account of the Student Senate tweeted, quote, "On behalf of the Student Senate, we humbly apologize for the video President Megan Marzek posted." Since then, Marzek, who was voted into Senate on a radical ticket to democratize the Student Senate, including organizing and unionizing students for more student power, has faced calls for her resignation. During a public Student Senate meeting on September 10th, members of the on-campus group Bobcats for Israel were arrested while attempting to filibuster a Student Senate meeting, according to reports. Inside Higher Ed reported that, quote, "members of Bobcats for Israel called the threats against Marzek unacceptable, but also demanded that she resign. In a quickly escalating exchange, the protesters continued to read from a conservative website called Legal Insurrection, even after the Senate leaders told them to allow other students to speak. After about 10 minutes, including a two-minute warning from police, four of the students were arrested. Marzek then reportedly stood on a table and announced that she would, quote, "never apologize for standing up for the people of Palestine, and I will never stand up for fascists, and this body won't either." The four students have since been released. They were charged with disrupting a lawful meeting, a misdemeanor that carries with it a possible sentence of 30 days in jail. An associate film professor at the university said that at least one male member of Bobcats for Israel carried himself, quote, "in a menacing manner that led concerned faculty members to step in between the protesters and Marzek, fearing for her safety in light of the threats that she has received." I spoke with Megan Marzek on Thursday, September 11th.
My name is Megan Marzek. I am president of Ohio University Student Senate. So, let's see, the second week of classes, I produced a video in response to the president of Ohio University, Roderick McDavis, challenging me to do the ALS bucket challenge. And when I received word that I had been challenged, it seemed like really the only way I would respond to the ALS Bucket Challenge, which was to make a video in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. So I made a blood bucket video, which is, to my understanding, a very common thing currently in the Palestinian liberation movement. And so I made a statement of who I was responding to the fact I had been challenged by the president as Ohio University Student Senate president. made a statement about the occupation of Palestine by Israel, and I made a call for a divestment from Israel from Ohio University.
And what was the immediate response from your community, other student senators, and then kind of the broader media after that?
It took about a day to really get any response. I mean, keep in mind, I made this video just hoping that maybe one or two people would become interested in BDS on campus. So it took about a day for anything significant to happen, but quickly the sort of Zionist presence on campus began writing to the Student Senate email, expressing distaste and a misguided PR member of Student Senate apologized on my behalf, on behalf of Student Senate, for my video, which then immediately linked the video and my personal political views to Student Senate, and there was very quickly a national Zionist reaction. So on Thursday, the death threats started coming in. I received thousands of hate emails, including death threats and rape threats. I was harassed on Facebook. On Thursday was when I disabled all social media. But I also should also say that on the day and the day after that I had posted it, many of, you know, the people in my sort of organizing community, social justice community, were reposting the video, you know, with enthusiasm. So, I mean, the immediate response was very positive. And then the, like, wider, you know, Zionist reaction is exactly in line with all Zionist reactions of anyone speaking out in like, for Palestine. So on the Thursday following the Tuesday that I posted the video, I was called to meet with the executive vice president of the university, who was also the advisor for Student Senate. So we actually had a regular meeting scheduled. But when I came in, I was given a printout of an email of a death threat that was directed towards me and the president of the university, and was notified that criminal charges had already been pursued, and the protocol of this level of threat caused the Ohio University campus police to contact Homeland Security. So I was notified that Homeland Security was monitoring all hits of my name and the video on the internet. I was recommended to go into protective housing on campus and to not walk alone. I was offered police escort. I was told to call immediately if any more threats were made. Yes.
Wow.
And so the days, like, quickly after the video, there were, like, immediate calls for my resignation, an overwhelming amount of calls for my resignation from local and international Zionist organizations, and just Zionists on their own behalf, calling the university. And the university, the president's and vice president's office, were shut down for an entire day to field phone calls and emails from Zionists. It's very clear on why the backlash, the negative backlash, has been really put in front of any support, because it's very clear who has institutional power in this situation. We have a very, very highly funded, supported by the university, Zionist group called Hillel, which is in conjunction with Bobcats for Israel and AEPI. You know, we're talking a lot of money and institutional support, whereas it's very clear that those who would speak in support of me or really in support of Palestinian and Arab students not only do not have, you know, organizations to help them, they are at huge risk for their lives, their visas, their return home safely. So there was not any organized support for me that night, which going into the meeting did not seem so dangerous. But as the next week went on, the death threats came in, the rape threats, the extremely horrendous media coverage, extremely biased, a lot of false reporting. The Thursday that I received the majority of my death threats, I was obviously like, you know, I was like talking with police, communicating with Homeland Security, etc. I was unable to talk to journalists all day, and I went to our campus, like our main student newspaper that night, showed, you know, this highly conservative editor who edits and manages all coverage of Student Senate, who has, you know, we have our existing problems, but showed him the death threats, explained it. I was getting emails from Homeland Security while I was talking to him. I explained to him what I explained to you. The next day, all that was in the papers was, you know, a quote of me saying, I've received death threats. So it was very clear from the beginning that we were not going to get accurate media coverage. I got absolutely no public support from the university at all. No, like, public concern for my safety, etc., which is to be expected. I have been organizing direct action against the administration since my freshman year here.
That was Megan Marzek, Student Senate President of Ohio University, speaking to us on September 11th. Finally, we go to Illinois, where Nader Ehmoud reports from an action for Palestine in Palos Hills.
Whether you are from Palos Hills or Palestine, San Francisco or Syria, Ireland or Iraq, today we will run and walk as one. But we have more than just one message. Today, we run and walk for love, for hope, justice, happiness, freedom, for the hungry, for the poor. Today, we run and walk for peace.
That was Rush Darwish addressing the runners and walkers right before they participated in the Run and Walk for Peace at Moraine Valley Community College in Palos Hills, a suburb of Chicago, on September 14th. The money raised by the walk and run is donated to the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund. The funds pay for doctors around the world to fly to Palestine and the rest of the Middle East to complete procedures on children who desperately need medical attention. This past summer, Israel's attacks on Gaza left more than 2,100 Palestinians dead, including more than 500 children, and over 11,000 have been injured. Team Palestine, which helped plan and host the event with Moraine Valley Community College's Arab Student Union, has raised thousands of dollars by running the Chicago Marathon. This year will be the fifth time Team Palestine has competed in the annual event. The team has grown from 15 members to 50 since being created, and last year, Team Palestine and Run for Peace raised approximately $70,000 for PCRF. Darwish estimated that Team Palestine and Run for Peace will raise $100,000 this year. More than 1,000 people registered for Walk and Run for Peace 2014. The race, which has been held at Moraine Valley each of the past 3 years, was open to the streets of Palos Hills. After last year's Walk and Run, Palos Hills Mayor Gerald Bennett promised to open the city streets to those running the 5K.
And yes, last year I said we'd open up the streets, and you have accommodated your own organization by turning out in vast numbers, so give yourselves a round of applause.
The Chicago Marathon is less than a month away, and runners are still trying to raise money as October 12th approaches. But Darwish, a member of Team Palestine, said the support received at Run for Peace motivates the marathon runners.
Now we're 3 weeks away from doing 26 miles, and it means the world to us.
Following the run, food and drinks were distributed to the participants. Arabic music was played throughout the event, but after the walk and run, people were encouraged to do debka, traditional Palestinian line dancing. PCRF has 3 offices and field staff on the ground in Gaza who work to identify and treat the children affected by Israel's 51-day assault. The organization is still in the midst of mapping out the children who have been killed and injured in Gaza. The Palestinian Children's Relief Fund's Mike Lowe told the Electronic Intifada, quote, "It's important for people all across the world to come together to do something about this, to make people more aware of the struggle people are going through." Lowe added that, quote, "Just the simple things that we're trying to provide for them, such as medical care, just isn't available to them, which is available to people outside of Gaza and other places in the world." For the Electronic Intifada in Palos Hills, I'm Nader Hamoud.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of writers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
That was a special podcast produced by the Electronic Intifada. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. Technology Bites is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
Hi, Laurie McNeil.
Hi, John Wilkerson.
We are back to tell you more about the KPFT Tennis Fun Fest.
It will be at the Homer Ford Tennis Center in McGregor Park. Previously, we didn't have enough time to tell you about our clinic.
Laurie, I've got a question for you. Did you enjoy tennis more playing against the best players in the world, or do you enjoy it more now giving clinics?
John, as a player, Wimbledon is it. But there's also something special about coaching.
You mean when you're coaching at the Zena Garrison Tennis Academy and at the KPFT Tennis Fun Fest?
Yes, it's rewarding to offer a tip and to see a player improve right before my eyes.
And that's what you expect on Saturday, October the 11th at the KPFT Tennis Fun Fest?
Absolutely, but people have to sign up. All levels are welcome.
For more information, go to kpft.org or call 713-526-4000.
That's 713-526-4000. The fee is $75 for adults and $60 for kids, but kids' scholarships are available.
We'll see you there.
Do you or someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up. And each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how Houston eateries can lend a helping hand to KPFT. Ideal locations will be close to downtown Houston and be able to provide meals for 12 hungry volunteers. Again, that's 713-526-4000 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpfthouston.